The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
And here we are. Welcome to a Friday, everyone. I am Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network. So it's Friday, and this is the weekend that we turn our clocks ahead. Yes, we spring forward. So that's good news in that it means spring is just about around the corner. The bad news is we lose an hour of sleep on Saturday night. And on Tuesday, of all things, I have jury duty. So there will be no new show on Tuesday, just a warning right now. I plan on being back Wednesday, so I hope they don't have any plans on putting me in a jury for a case that lasts more than a day. But daylight savings time starts Saturday night, Sunday morning. And here in Florida, the legislature has passed a bill called the Sunshine Protection Act. It just passed the Senate 33-2, and it would keep Florida on daylight savings time year round. Now, daylight savings time as it stands now, I think, runs about 8 months, and standard time is only 4 months. And daylight savings time, it stays lighter longer at the end of the day. Let me share with you an article from the Associated Press. They write, Florida is a step closer to living up to its nickname as the Sunshine State. A bill to let Florida remain on daylight savings time year-round is headed to Governor Rick Scott's desk after the state Senate approved it 33-2. If Scott signs the Sunshine Protection Act, Congress would need to amend existing federal law to allow the change. While the rest of the eastern United States would set their clocks back in the fall, Florida wouldn't, leaving it with more sunshine in the evening during the winter, which I could go for, actually. Northwest Florida is currently in the central time zone. Hawaii, most of Arizona, and a few of the U.S. territories, including American Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands, do not observe daylight savings time. That's interesting. Early this Sunday, Floridians will spring forward, as will most of the rest of the country, setting their clocks ahead 1 hour. It's an interesting concept, but I don't know that I honestly don't think Rick Scott will sign it. And Speedbird 9 in the chat room just said, I hate getting up in the dark. And that's what it's going to be, is if this passes. There are going to be times during the winter, yeah, it'll stay lighter later, but the sun may not come up until 8:30 in the morning. And apparently the last time they did this, back in like 74, during the energy crisis, they extended daylight savings time year-round, ostensibly for 2 years, but they wound up cutting it back on the second year because there were kids going out, you know, to get the bus for school in the morning, and they were getting killed because it was dark out. So, going out waiting for the bus when the streets are dark. We'll see what happens. I somehow, Florida is, you know, Florida. And as much as I'd love to see daylight savings time year round, that would have to be the whole country for it to really make sense. I can hear my husband screaming, even though he's not even here in the house. He wants this bad because he's never up before 8:30 in the morning. Anyway, so that's what's going on there. Regardless, the clocks go back move ahead 1 hour. This really sucks that my jury duty is Tuesday, because I'll still be adjusting to the it being an hour earlier. But yes, jury duty got me. They originally got me in, I think it was September. And I said, you know, I put back the response, you know, I'm self-employed. I don't get paid if I don't work. Well, I guess I sort of do. Tried to get out of it, and they delayed it for 6 months, but I'm in. And I think it's, you know, I think it is a civic responsibility that we serve on jury duty. So hopefully I'll have an easy case or none at all, and I will be back on Wednesday. Okay? All right. Let's see, what else is going on? The news about North Korea is pretty wild, huh? That came in last night, 7 o'clock, with the South Korea's national security advisor going outside of the White House to deliver the statement that there's going to be a meeting. You know why it was South Korea's national security advisor? Because we don't have a South Korean ambassador. We've got nobody handling that part of the world. And apparently Trump was all giddy when he got the communication that Kim Jong-il wanted to meet with him, because he thought, oh, it's something that'll take the media's attention away from Stormy Daniels. In fact, somebody named Jeffrey Lewis, who tweets at arms control wonk, so you know he's one of those people, here's his take on it. He wrote, North Korea has been seeking a summit with an American president for more than 20 years. It has literally been a top foreign policy goal of Pyongyang since Kim Jong-il invited Bill Clinton. I wonder if Trump's aides have explained that to him, or if in their toddler handling, they've led him to believe that this offer is something unusual. Or perhaps he imagines that only he can go to Pyongyang. This is literally how the North Korean film The Country I Saw ends. An American president visits Pyongyang, compelled by North Korea's nuclear and missile programs to treat Kim as an equal. And then he ends with, P.S., to be clear, we need to talk to North Korea, but Kim is not inviting Trump so that he can surrender North Korea's weapons. Kim is inviting Trump to demonstrate that his investment in nuclear and missile capabilities has forced the United States to treat him as an equal. Now, Sarah Sanders did hold a press briefing today, and of course, this was the thing that was most asked about, and she seemed to back down a little bit on the certainty that this meeting will happen. And she said, despite all the criticisms, that we got nothing out of it, and they got everything. She said, no, there will be no meeting unless they commit to denuclearizing or something of that ilk. She didn't go quite that far, but she also didn't go quite so far as to assure us that this meeting would take place. So we'll see what happens. Before we get to what's news and our guest today, by the way, who's Amy Simon, in honor of Women's History Month and yesterday's International Women's Day. Amy Simon, if she's history, and if you haven't heard Amy, I think you'll enjoy listening to her. She's a cultural historian. She's coming up in a few minutes. On the subject of school shootings, there's an active shooting situation going on in a veterans home, and I believe in California right now, somewhere on the West Coast. It's every day there's something else. Well, listen to this. In the Netherlands yesterday, a 44-year-old man with severe mental issues attacked a high school in the Netherlands. Since he didn't have access to guns, he brought knives, and he was scared away by students throwing their backpacks at him. No guns, no shooting, no death. The man is now getting help. You see how that works? Yeah. There's other news. Pharma bro Martin Scorsese, remember him? Yeah, well, he was sentenced to 7 years in jail for defrauding investors. And that Wu-Tang Clan album that he bought, the one copy of, he lost that too. And he was fined all kinds of money as well. Apparently, he cried, which, you know, too bad. I'm sure those tears would be worth something on the open market. And the other big news, what? You demand equal time? You know, you don't go to sleep at 9:30 like some people do. Okay. Yes. Anyway, Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, used his Trump Organization email while arranging to transfer money into an account at a Manhattan bank before he wired $130,000 to Stormy Daniels to buy her silence. This is new news today from NBC reporting that. So, you know, this whole Stormy Daniels story is spiraling. Of course, we've got the whole Kim Jong-il Kim Jong-un meeting, or alleged to be coming meeting, to distract us from it. Because you know that's what it's all about, right? I thought you did. All right, let's take a break. We'll check in with, we'll get our news and what's news, and we'll check in with Amy Simon in just a couple of minutes. So stick around. I am Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
I read the news today.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un has asked Donald Trump for talks, and Trump has agreed to meet him, according to South Korea's national security advisor in a statement issued at the White House Thursday evening.
Just hours after the president unexpectedly popped into the press room to say there would be a surprise announcement on North Korea, South Korea's national security advisor walked outside the White House to announce that North Korea's Kim Jong-un invited President Trump to nuclear negotiations, and the president has accepted.
President Trump appreciated the briefing and said he would meet Kim Jong-un by May to achieve permanent denuclearization.
NBC's Hallie Jackson was there for that moment and joins us live from the White House. Hallie, how did this come about?
Quickly, and as a surprise to a lot of folks, even inside the West Wing, Chris. So let me sort of take you through the evening, and then we can get into the policy implications of this, because the policy implications are real. And as you mentioned, we have now learned that the White House, the president, has accepted this invitation to meet Kim Jong-un. President Trump, you said in the briefing room, which may be generous, it was like half a shoulder and a half a head as he popped his head in, to say that there was going to be an announcement on a big subject tonight. The president has never done this. I've been covering this administration since moment one, have never seen the president come out into the briefing room door like that. He clearly wanted to talk. He clearly wanted to share some information with the reporters. That set off what was roughly a 90-minute scramble by staffers who were huddling inside the West Wing to figure out who was going to be present at this briefing by the South Korean National Security Advisor, as you ultimately saw, where it would happen. Presumably, they knew what would be said, at least at that point. NBC News quickly confirmed that there was a letter that Kim Jong-un wrote to President Trump, a letter delivered via the South Koreans to the president. And we now know that presumably that letter indicated a desire to meet with Donald Trump. The White House is going to make that happen. As this announcement was happening from the National Security Advisor, you had a number of aides who were standing outside when the South Korean advisor said that the president would be meeting in May. We still don't know exactly when, Chris. We still don't know where this is going to happen, and that is really a big question here.
Yep.
And we don't know sort of who knew about this, because I'll tell you what, in Ethiopia this morning, you had, guess who, the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who was specifically asked about negotiations with North Korea and said they were still a long way off. May is not that long off, Chris. We're already, what, first week of March here, you know? So there's that piece of the puzzle. From a policy perspective, this is significant because, remember, you just had that South Korean delegation come back from Pyongyang, that first meeting in roughly 10 years in which they got face-to-face with Kim Jong-un, coming over to debrief, for example, H.R. McMaster and others, including the president and the vice president, about what had happened. And that's where we learned this news, Chris. So I'll tell you what, it's been a roller coaster 3 hours here at the White House, and I expect it is not over just yet.
Tonight, we learned about an official invitation from Kim Jong-un to meet Trump. Wow.
Wow.
This can only mean one thing. Dennis Rodman is going to get the Nobel Peace Prize. We don't know all the details yet, but because North Korea is an economically starved country, the invitation is BYO everything. They had a representative from South Korea actually bring the invitation and make the announcement. So North Korea gave a letter to South Korea, who gave it to the Trump administration. And one thing we do know is that during the talks, North Korea said it would suspend its nuclear tests. So that's progress. They've gone from "we'll blow up Guam" to "we pinky swear not to blow up Guam for a few days." Nobody knows where this will end up. This is all so fresh. But Trump gave us a hint of his vision for the end of 70 years of hostility on the Korean Peninsula when he told a reporter, "Hopefully, you will give me credit." I will happily give you credit. How about bringing peace to your own country first? Here's the craziest part, delivered by the South Korean delegation.
President Trump appreciated the briefing and said he would meet Kim Jong-un by May to achieve permanent denuclearization.
We'll finally find out who has a bigger button.
On Thursday, Trump signed an order imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum, but said the U.S. is holding off on tariffs for Mexico and Canada. The tariffs are set at 25% for foreign steel and 10% for foreign aluminum, with the possibility of partners removing tariffs through talks. In remarks, the president stressed the countries need to protect and build steel and aluminum for national security purposes while maintaining, quote, flexibility and cooperation with friends of ours. He also said that the tariffs would protect jobs in America and stop the, quote, desolation of entire communities due to foreign dumping of the metals. Trump claimed that before the tariffs, the U.S. was being treated very badly by other countries, politicians, and presidents. The U.S. economy added 313,000 jobs in February, beating expectations as the unemployment rate held steady at 4.1%. As the nation springs forward to daylight savings time this weekend, the Florida legislature has passed the Sunshine Protection Act, which would keep Florida on daylight savings time year-round. The bill now heads to the governor's desk. If he signs it, Congress would need to amend existing federal law to allow the change. I got the news. And that's a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener-funded, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.
These are the sounds of crushed souls. The sounds of despair from former radio personalities, languishing in the purgatory of corporate consolidation. These former radio personalities have lost their livelihoods, not because they weren't entertaining or informative, but because they don't meet today's corporate terrestrial broadcast standards of being smelly, overweight douchebags, seething with vein-popping hatred. These radio refugees and their audiences have since migrated to the internet, but their struggle continues as the quest for monetization ensues. Nicole Sandler is leading the way to reestablishing thought-provoking and entertaining radio. And you can help by clicking the donate button on NicoleSandler.com. Donate today, or as much and as often as you can. Dry the tears of listeners by removing the rotting stench of corporate radio. Won't you help?
You're listening to The Nicole Sandler Show on Progressive Voices and NicoleSandler.com.
It's time for Amy Simon of She's History, the most dangerous women in America, then and now.
Because I'm a woman, W-O-M-A-N, and that's all.
All right. Yes, it is Women's History Month. Yesterday was International Women's Day. International Women's Day, is that right, Amy?
Yes.
Yes. And so, and I'm, as I always am when she joins us, I'm thrilled to welcome Amy Simon back to the show. She's a cultural historian. She's the creator, writer, performer of She's History, a show, The Most Dangerous Women in America Then and Now. Hello, Amy Simon.
It has been too long.
Yes, it has. So happy belated International Women's Day and happy Women's History Month.
Thank you. It's so funny when people say that to me, and I've gotten, you know, texts and emails and all kinds of people in my world telling me yesterday stuff they're reading online and seeing about it. But, you know, when I hear Happy Women's International Day or Happy Women, I'm like, well, you know, it actually started because women weren't being treated fairly and workers weren't treated fairly. I mean, International Women's Day, March 8th, which is my daughter's birthday.
Aww.
And I just have to say, announce to the listening world that I did not plan on having two daughters in Women's History Month, but
you're both
somehow
March babies,
the world was telling me something.
Wow.
Yeah, I had to put that in. So it really started because workers weren't being treated fairly. It started in New York City, Women's International Day, with the Socialist Party. Imagine that. And it was factory workers, which mostly employed women and children without any protection or wages. And that's really what started it. I mean, it really blossomed and moved into an international movement. But it was actually in 1911 when the shirtwaist factory fire happened. This was a garment factory in New York City, and the women were locked into their, you know, jobs, literally physically locked in, and there was a fire that started. There weren't fire escapes. You know, there were no laws to protect workers, and these women threw themselves out of the window. It was a horrific, horrific story, but it did lead to protest and public awareness, and, you know, on and on, and like everything else, it built on itself and created laws and protections for women. And I'll tell you the coolest story about Women's History Month. But when people say Happy Women's International Day, I get sad. You know, it's like, yeah, thank you. We're happy for the attention. But, you know, we still have quite a way to go.
Yes, that is definitely true. So what's the story about Women's History Month?
I love this story so much because I got to interview the woman who made it happen.
Ooh.
Because I know I get excited. You might have to tell me to calm down a little bit. But it's just been so long since I've been on. And everything sort of ties into each other. You know, I really kind of started doing She's History. I realize now that it really started in 2007, 2008. That's how long that I have been learning, educating myself about women's roles. And, you know, I call my play now, She's History, a play about women who make and made history. Just to make it more clear, you know, as I try to publicize it, promote it, get bookings, get into the schools, even though The Most Dangerous Woman in America is still fine, but, you know, I do both.
Okay.
But I started doing it because it was a confluence of things. It was Hillary Clinton running, it was being the mother of two daughters in our society, and it was going through a really terrible divorce. During a time when it was the worst economy since the Depression, and I couldn't get hired, and that's when I learned about maternal profiling. So everything led me into the library to do research, because we do not learn about our women's history. I mean, we really are just starting to, and I know we're going to get to it, Nicole, but this year really is a shift, and I bring up the fact that I've been doing this so long, because ever since I've been doing it, and people are very attracted to it, and I always have no trouble bragging about it because I'm the messenger. You know, it's not about me. It's about the women who make, you know, what you do possible and a lot of things possible. So I'm happy to brag about it, but I've heard for years that this is the year of the woman. Ever since my first play, Cheerios in My Underwear, inspired by being a stay-at-home mom and going through that world and beginning the research on women, and then people would come see the play and they'd relate and they'd say, oh, it's the year of the woman. It's been like 20 years.
That has been the year of the woman, right.
You know, and also, you know, if you think back, and you know, I'm going to ping around all over the place, but even in the early 90s when for the first time there were like 20 women in Congress, and people were like, yeah, we're really getting there. I'm like, well, we started at the bottom. You know, anything is progress. So it's easy, you know, to applaud it. And I celebrate every teeny little bit that we, you know, progress. But anyway, the way Women's History Month started was by a woman, a teacher in California in 1972. And her name is Molly McGregor. And there are some links on my website, sheshistory.com, which will, you know, take you into any of the stories that I'm going to tell you about today. But the National Women's History Project is Molly McGregor's baby. And she was a history teacher in 1972 here in California, in Sonoma. And she was teaching a class. And there was a boy, a young high school boy in her class who happened to see this new magazine called Ms. Magazine. And he saw this magazine and he was like, what is the women's movement? Because it was split, you know, splash all over the first cover. And he said, what is the women's movement? He was so glad that he asked her that on a Friday because she needed the entire weekend to come up with the answer. And keep in mind, for any of the listeners, whatever age, 1970s was a really explosive year for the women's movement. So everything was happening. So she says to the boy, that's a good question. She goes home, and now she's a history teacher, and she's also like a history buff. And she starts looking in her own personal extensive library of history books, and she can find one book called Freedom Ferment with one chapter on Seneca Falls. Now, Seneca Falls, again, everyone, this is on my website. You can read all about it. Was in 1848 was the first organized women's convention in our country. It was a really, really big deal, turning point in women's history, launched an entire movement of women's conventions, and so it was a big deal. So meanwhile, this is 1972, and Congress has finally passed, well, not passed, they said yes to the Equal Rights Amendment. And I'm almost nervous to bring up the Equal Rights Amendment, Nicole, when I talk to you, because I know your head explodes and you just can't understand why we still don't have an Equal Rights Amendment.
It's amazing to me.
And I know, and join the party. And yep. And in my play, She's History, I tell a really good story about the Equal Rights Amendment and Seneca Falls, you know, and a lot of the women's battle for equality, as the great Bella Abzug would say. But the Equal Rights Amendment was actually written in 1923.
Mm-hmm.
Just let that get in there for a minute, by Alice Paul, who was an amazing pioneer of the women's movement. It was initially called the Lucretia Mott Amendment. And Lucretia Mott was another fabulous unknown woman in our history that we don't know too much about. The first woman to be allowed to preach in public, because she was a Quaker and the Quakers educated their women. And she mentored Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was the architect of the women's movement, who partnered with Susan B. Anthony. And you would have never heard of Susan B. Anthony if it weren't for Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And I love telling the story because it's like a chain, like a thread. We all come from somebody else. You know, every woman inspires, you know, more. Anyway, back to the Equal Rights Amendment in 1972. You know, it was doing well. It was on its way to being ratified because you need 35 out of 38 states, and we had 35. But then this other woman comes along who is not a fan of the Equal Rights Amendment, and her name was Phyllis Schlafly.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, for us older gals, we know all about Phyllis Schlafly. She was brilliant, a brilliant strategist, and she stopped the movement. She was religious. She was like the Tea Party, you know, of her day. And, you know, just an absolute nightmare, but very smart. Unfortunately, she was a feminist, but she didn't know it because she had many children, but she was actually a working mom. And, you know, they used to tell her that, and it drove her crazy. But she started the anti-Equal Rights Amendment movement, and she was successful. So it was just an unbelievable time in our history in the 1970s. There were now, by this time, there were women's studies programs being started. So, and Molly McGregor, back to this fabulous female who is responsible for Women's History Month, by this time she has this, like, this summer school course in Sonoma College. It's called Sexism in Education, which is not all. I mean, it's 1972. You have to realize, in 1972, a woman could not sign for her own house. She couldn't get a credit card without her husband's permission or signature. I mean, the oppression was insane. It was the 70s when, you know, Bella Abzug and Ms. Magazine and the Women's Lib movement, you know, did basic things like stopped having ads in the newspaper that were for male or female, or, you know, having women sent home from the courtroom to put on a pair of put on a skirt because they wore slacks. I mean, this is the 1970s. It's
right.
Crazy.
Wow.
So we're starting, you know, to have these women's studies programs. And I have to say, I was a theater major and went to college in the 70s and took, you know, women's studies courses, and I wouldn't have been able to do it if it weren't for people like Molly McGregor. Anyway, so she has this class, you know, Sexism in Education. It had 36 students. They were 18 girls and they were 18 boys. So the boys, they do the slideshow on, you know, Seneca Falls and the whole Declaration of Sentiments, and I tell this great story in my play. And they go through all this stuff. And so she decides, she's now in graduate school, time goes on, and she decides that she wants to have, like, this women's history parade. And she goes to this education task force, and it gets a little specific here. But, you know, the way she did it, she said it was really easy because she went to this task force. It was this commission on the status of women. And back in, by the way, as I bounce around, it was 1948 that Eleanor Roosevelt and another woman named Esther Peterson convinced President Kennedy to create a status of women where they actually studied what was going on with women and why we didn't have, you know, what we don't have. So now we're back into the 70s. And she, you know, brings this proposal to these committee in Sonoma, California, to this administrative council. She's like, you know, we need to have this parade. We need to have this celebration. And she made this multicultural perspective aimed at girls, emphasizing the need for math and science. And there was some easy sell because there was some new statistic that just came out saying that, you know, 9 out of 10 girls were going to end up not working outside of the home. And she said it was just a very easy sell. So they have this big parade in California. And they invite, you know, all these women, they come into the schools, they do these role models, and, you know, every year they do it another year, and they take all these pictures, and it's a big deal in this little town, Sonoma, California. Well, this publicity gets Molly McGregor. She gets invited to this 19-day big institute at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. And this is organized by a fabulous female named Gerda Lerner, who was this pioneer. She's the one who started the entire women's studies programs in our country, started in California. So she goes, I just love this part of the story. So she goes and attends this summer institute. Now, she's an academic, you know, and she's got all the props and everything. And she's there with Gerda Lerner and all these others. This is Molly McGregor telling me this story. I'm on the phone with her a couple of years ago. That's how I got all the goods.
Right.
And there were all these major scholars there, you know, a woman named Amy Swerdlow and all these, you know, really cool women. So they're very prominent. And they think Molly is the bomb. You know, they can't get over what she's doing. And again, it's like a harmonious, I call it a harmonious convergence of the timing. You know, it was the 70s and everything was happening. So guess who these women are all friends with? Molly says to me, she goes, guess who these women were all these prominent scholars were very good friends with? President Carter.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So they organize, they start promoting Molly's idea for this Women's History Week, a week. So Molly goes home to Sonoma, she drops out of grad school, and she creates the National Women's History Project in 1980. And this was, you know, now it's an online thing, but back then it was, you know, just a little grassroots thing. And then Molly says this to me on the phone. She goes, I'll never forget this. It's February 1980. I'm sitting at my desk, and I get a call from the White House.
Yeah.
Now, today, I think if you get a call from the White House, it might make you a little nervous.
Yes.
not quite the same kind of thing. But for her, she gets, you know, look at her. She's a teacher. You know, this whole thing's going on. And it was the special assistant to President Carter, Sarah Weddington. And I hope that name is a little bit
name.
Familiar to any.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, Sarah Weddington of Roe v. Wade.
That's right.
Yeah. She was the 26-year-old Texas lawyer. She successfully represented a Jane. So she's the one who calls Molly McGregor. And she says, oh, President Carter is declaring the week of March 8th, 1980, as National Women's History Week. Ah! And so she says it took 6 years after that to make it Women's History Month. That's how it happened. And every year since, there's been a special presidential proclamation which honors the extraordinary achievements of American women. So Women's History Month is actually a very, very cool thing. And like I said to your listeners, you can just look up the National Women's History Project or go to my website. It's in one of the links and, you know, read some more cool stories. But that's how Women's History Month started.
Well, that is cool. So sometimes it's the efforts of one woman who can make a change.
Yeah, I think it's definitely the efforts of one person, you know, and I like to talk about this too because there are lots of men that made women's progress possible that were you know, supporters of women. As many and many men that, you know, obviously kept women down. And there were women like Phyllis Schlafly, you know, all through our history that did not think women should have equal rights with men, even really wonderful feminists who made, you know, the first woman preacher in America, Antoinette Blackwell, and I'll tell her story because she's related to the coolest family ever.
Okay.
She was the first ordained minister. I mean, she had to go through, no pun intended, hell to, you know, become the first ordained back in the 1830s. And she thought women's place was in the home. And even Catherine Beecher Stowe, who was like a pioneer in women's education, she also thought women should be educated so that they could stay at home and take care of the men and raise good boys. So it's just fascinating to see all the different stories of what inspires women. And even Eleanor Roosevelt, she also thought, not that a woman's place exactly was in the home, but she thought a woman's first priority was to her family, and she was an uber feminist. So, you know, it's always interesting like that. And I really like to look at the roles that families play, that fathers play, because you look at somebody like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, whose story I tell a lot about, because she really was the architect of the women's movement. And everyone has heard of Susan B. Anthony, who got arrested for voting in 1872. And, you know, she has the coin, and she's a much better known feminist pioneer, women's advocate. But we really would not have known of her if it weren't for Elizabeth Cady Stanton. The two of them came together. And Susan B. Anthony became inspired by a woman named Lucy Stone. And I kind of wanted to talk about her a little bit because the biggest theme that I can find, and today too, in today's world, that has never changed, and it's actually worse globally today, I think, or else we have more attention on it, is the factor of education in keeping women and other down, or just oppressed people. I mean, without education is the key, and it's always been the key.
Mm-hmm.
And women were never allowed to be educated, you know. I mean, it's been a battle, a fight for every single drip drop of education for women. And today, I read a story today about a woman, you know, the whole Mideast and what's going on with ISIS and the Taliban and these, you know, Sharia law. I mean, in our lifetime, it's still going on. Women are not being allowed to be educated.
Right.
And I mean, women just revolted in Saudi Arabia this year to drive.
Right. But what I found out, and it's funny, I saw a story on it today, women will be allowed to drive. Some of them are now learning to drive, but they have to have the permission of a male sponsor in order to drive. And there are limitations on where they can drive. They cannot drive to work.
Yeah. Limitations.
Yes.
Absolute roadblocks. I mean, our world in many parts of the world, and it seems to me mostly in the Mideast, is just oppression. I mean, I don't want to go down that road of how, you know, terrible it is, but, you know, what started me thinking about Lucy Stone, who was, you know, the pioneer of women's rights in the 1800s, and I love her story so much because I say, are you a Lucy Stoner? Lucy Stone is known mostly because she was one of the first woman that we know of that did not take her husband's name.
Hmm.
This is like huge. This is like such
like me.
A big deal.
Yeah. Okay.
Like a million of us. I mean, actually, the first fight I ever had with my now ex-husband was when we went to get our marriage license. And he just assumed I was going to take his name.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, what?
Right.
What made you think that?
Uh-huh.
And I was like, you know what? I'll tell you what. If you drop your name and take mine, I'll do the same thing. And he was like, don't be absurd. So anyway, we're not married anymore. So there you go.
All right. So tell us about Lucy Stone.
What?
Tell us about Lucy Stone.
Okay.
Okay.
So Lucy Stone, she was born in 1818. Mm-hmm. And, you know, women had, like, no rights. They couldn't own anything. They couldn't inherit anything. You know, it was just terrible. And she didn't even get married until she was 37. But that's when she decided to keep her name. But she, you know, she married. I know I was going to talk about fathers, but you know, the role of men in women's history. She married a really cool progressive man, Henry Brown Blackwell. His sister was Antoinette Blackwell,
okay,
who was the first ordained minister. And his other sister was Elizabeth Blackwell. She was America's first female doctor. And you know, her story too, what she went through to get a degree in, you know, medicine was just insane. So, but Lucy, she was called the Morning Star of the women's movement. And another reason I was thinking of her was when Frances McDormand made her speech, one of her speeches I was watching, not at the Oscars, I think it was at the Brit Awards. And she said, I love an organized act of civil disobedience. And she was referencing what's going on right now with the whole Me Too movement. And immediately I think of Lucy Stone, because Lucy Stone was the first woman in America to be arrested for civil disobedience. And she was arrested because she wouldn't pay her property tax. Now, she owned property, which is unusual. But in America in that time, the only people who could vote were property owners. Well, she was a property owner, but they wouldn't let her vote. And so she got pissed off, and she goes, well, I'm not paying my damn taxes. You can come and take me. And they did. She got arrested. So she's kind of known for that. But she, you know, she was just one of those women. She grew up on a farm. She had 8 siblings. Like, her mother was milking a cow the night before Lucy Stone was born. I mean, mm-hmm. when you think of what our people went through when the country was young, and just the hard physical labor, just getting through each day to survive, you know. And I think when I used to say to my kids, go make your bed, I would remember that, you know, back then they had to actually make their bed, you know, physically make their bed. So, I don't know, I just kind of thought that was kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so she had... you know, one of her jobs was to make 9 pairs of shoes a day, you know, and she just worked her ass off. They all did. I mean, Susan B. Anthony tells stories of how she had to take care of, you know, 30 boarders staying at her house, cooking,
wow,
cleaning, doing laundry. And then people wonder why she never wanted to get married and have kids. Because she knew how hard that life was. But back to Lucy Stone. She wanted to go to school. You know, she didn't understand why her brothers were being educated and she wasn't. And she watched her mother. It was really, again, this is like a theme, like women, young girls saw their moms suffer and their fathers and brothers have freedom. And, you know, seeds are planted. And that's how we got a lot of our wonderful pioneers. So Lucy was one of those, you know, her father ruled his home by the by great divinity or some religious bullshit. And she knew she didn't want that kind of a life. So she would beg her father to let her go to school. And he would say, what are you, crazy? Literally, this is what's in her daughter wrote her biography, by the way. It's called Lucy Stone, Pioneer of Women's Rights. Lucy Stone had one daughter, Alice Stone Blackwell, another great feminist. And, you know, I have her book. She wrote a book about her mom. So, you know, I kind of believe everything in it because it's her daughter. And, you know, her father said, what are you, crazy? And when he died, he left all of his property on all of the money to his sons.
Of course.
But he did give $200 each just to his daughters.
Okay.
$200, which is a lot of money. Anyway.
Right.
So it takes Lucy Stone 9 years to save up for college. 9 years. And she, at 25 years old, and, you know, you can imagine how hard she had to work for that money. I mean, maybe college didn't cost what it does today, but still it was a fortune for a young girl milking cows and teaching and doing whatever she could while helping her sick mother and taking care of her family. She saves all this money, and she enters Oberlin College. Now, in 1840s, that was the only college in America that allowed women and African-Americans. Like, it was extremely progressive. It was in Ohio. And I love talking about Ohio because not just of Oberlin, but all kinds of wonderful women. Gloria Steinem came from Ohio. Victoria Woodhull, the first woman to run for president. So I just kind of go off on the Ohio thing. But so Lucy Stone goes to college. And, you know, that's the beginning of it. And she, you know, she finds out women can't even join the debate society in college. And it's a big deal, Oberlin, the debate society for the men. And she's writing speeches for the debate society, but she can't perform them because a woman wasn't allowed on a stage. So she starts having these secret women debate society, you know, on the outskirts of town. She gets somebody to, you know, offer their parlor, and she's, you know, teaching women how to speak and debate. And, you know, she goes on to meet her husband, and she marries him and keeps her name. She was 37, which by then you're an old maid.
Mm-hmm.
And she and her husband start this great suffrage magazine called The Woman's Journal. And, you know, she just goes on. Now it's middle of the 1800s when the women's movement, the first wave really is happening. And somewhere Susan B. Anthony reads about Lucy Stone's speech at one of these big meetings she has, these suffrage meetings. And, you know, the women really learned how to organize for their own rights. They fought for the Negroes' rights. I mean, the women had a huge part in abolition. That is how they learned how to organize. They joined temperance movements. They didn't think people should drink, but they learned how to organize and pass legislation. And then when the 14th Amendment comes along and, you know, the black men are given the right to vote, the women are like, hello, you know, we're like right here.
Mm-hmm.
And the men are like, no, you know, it's not really your turn. We're going to just care of these black men and, you know, we'll get to you later. And that actually split the women's movement in half. And Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton were on the side of what was called universal suffrage. And they did not want to wait. They wanted to get what they wanted. And the Boston women, which was Lucy Stone and Julie Ward Howe and a bunch of women on that part in Boston, which was a mecca for this kind of thing and intellectual brainstorming and you know, I can't think of the word right now, but it split the because Lucy Stone and the others were like, you know, we are going to wait. And it took until the 1890s for the women to get back together, join up forces again. And it was in 1920 that the women's, you know, that the 19th Amendment got passed.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So anyways, I know I just went off on a tangent, but so Susan B. Anthony is in Rochester, New York, and she reads in the newspaper, a suffrage newspaper, an abolition newspaper, about this speech that Lucy Stone makes, and she decides to become a suffragist. And I always, you know, people say suffragette, and suffragette is if you're in London and you're fighting for equal rights for women, you're a suffragette, which I only ever heard that word from David Bowie's
song. Of course,
song.
Suffragette City,
right? We don't know what it is. And it wasn't until I was doing my play, She's History, that a women's history professor who I became very good friends with saw the play and heard me talking. And she goes, you know, as a suffragist is in America. And you know, there was a movement here of suffragists. And now I'm going to tell you a little bit about Alice Paul because it all ties together. And Alice Paul, who was a real, she's the one who wrote the Equal Rights Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So she was this very privileged, she was privileged. She grew up in New Jersey. She was a Quaker. And the Quakers were the very cool group in America. They were the first group to ban slavery. They were about equality and peace. They educated their women. They let them preach. I mean, they were like amazing group, the Quakers. And Alice Paul was a Quaker. So was Susan B. Anthony, was also a Quaker. So was President Nixon.
Yes.
So was William Penn, who's, you know, Penn, Pennsylvania. So it's the history of the Quakers is also pretty interesting. Although I always would tell, you know, my daughter Rose, who's a real girly girl, I don't know how that happened, but she is, and I was like, you would never make it as a Quaker because they couldn't wear makeup, they couldn't dress fancy, they didn't drink, they didn't listen to music. I mean, there were, you know, factions of Quakers that were, you know, really severe. Actually, Dolly Madison was also a Quaker when she was first married, and then when she, when her husband died, and she remarried Madison, she stopped being a Quaker and she started, you know, dressing like what I say, like Kim Kardashian. You know, she just went crazy and and became like this lovely hostess of Washington. But back to Alice Paul. So Alice Paul, she ended up getting educated in London. She went to England in the early 1900s and was mentored by Emmeline Pankhurst, who was the most famous suffragette. And there was a movie 2 years ago about her called Suffragette. And it was Meryl Streep who played Emmeline Pankhurst.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it's a really good movie. I would so encourage people to see that movie. It really tells you what women went through. She had to get violent. Not that I'm a proponent of violence, but, you know, they needed attention. So Emmeline Pankhurst organized women, and they went around London smashing windows so that they would get arrested, and they did. And then they would go to jail, and they did. And they went on hunger strikes, all of this to get the vote, and it worked. It worked for the Pankhurst. It took a long time, but it worked. So this is Alice Paul's over there, and she's taking, like, menial jobs and seeing how hard it is for women and getting paid nothing and working in these horrible factories. And she comes back to America. This is during President Wilson's reign, and she starts to organize women to vote. And she's a lady. You know, the thing that I love about Alice Paul is that she was this ball-busting, hunger-striking, 19th Amendment-passing, you know, brilliant, Ivy League-educated suffragist, but she was a lady. And, you know, she would sit and have tea and try to talk the men into, and she would sit with President Wilson every now and again, but he would not allow women to vote. And what really pissed him off was that when he became elected, he had this big inauguration like we do today. We had these giant inauguration parades.
Mm-hmm.
And President Wilson arrives in 1917. He arrives at Union Station in Washington, D.C. He's ready for his big parade. There's no one there. He's like, where are all the people? And they were all on the avenue watching Alice Paul's suffrage parade. She had organized 8,000 women, all dressed in white, to march down Pennsylvania Avenue and literally stole his attention. And there were 50,000 people half a million people watched this parade. This is 1919, the largest parade in Washington history. And I always say, just imagine what she could do with Facebook.
Right.
Imagine.
Right.
I mean, you know, well, that's how the Arab Spring happened. It was by that kind of thing. So she was a brilliant strategist and organizer. But the women really suffered at the parade. I mean, they were, you know, they had lit cigars thrown at them. They were mobbed. They were harassed. You know, they were beat. I mean, this and the police, they just looked the other way.
Wow.
So, you know, when you look at what activists go through, I mean, even in our time, you know, even a couple years ago, the whole 999 movement, I mean, people go to jail and get literally beaten for, you know, just standing up for. So anyway, Alice Paul pisses him off, and, you know, time goes on, and then now they start picketing in front of the White House for the right to vote. Now, they're allowed to. It was legal, and it was peaceful. For 18 months, they stood outside the White House. They were called the Silent Sentinels. And they had these signs, you know, how long must women wait for liberty? Because now it's World War I, and President Wilson joins the war, and he's going around fighting for liberty and saying that he's fighting for liberty. And Alice Paul's like, hello? How long must the women wait? But the women were seen as unpatriotic. They weren't, but they were, you know, seen that way. And finally, they get arrested. They're arrested for peacefully picketing in front of the White House. They're thrown into jail, and I mean physically, literally thrown into jail. This whole story is so horrible. It was called the Night of Terror. It was in November. Older women, I mean, these are, you know, I'm 61 years old. You know, my age women are out there with signs and being thrown against the wall. It's if you read the research, it's just like crazy, the literal stories that came out of that. Well, one of the women who was in there was, or was, one of the women was friends with a rich woman whose husband was connected, and the stories got out how terrible the women were being treated. They were in a workhouse, and they were not given food. And So Alice Paul goes on a hunger strike, which is what she did back in London. And for, I think it was like 2 weeks or a week, they force-feed her raw eggs. They stick tubes up her nose, down her throat, three times a day, and word gets out about Alice Paul. There's stuff in the newspaper, and the whole thing turns around. People get fired, and the women, you know, their stories get out there, and they gain momentum, and... You know, but the one of what, and they end up winning the right to vote with the passage of the 19th Amendment, which, by the way, was called the Susan B. Anthony Amendment. Thank you very much. And when Alice Paul was first thrown into jail, the government hired a shrink to say that she was insane, because back then, Nicole, that's what men threw women into the insane asylum all the time. They got out of hand. The men wanted to have an affair. I mean, it's Cornelius Vanderbilt, you know, famously the railroad baron, and his story is with Victoria Woodhull, the first woman to run for president. Victoria Woodhull's sister was basically Cornelius Vanderbilt's, you know, concubine, if you will, his mistress. And when his wife got wind of it, he threw her in the insane asylum. I mean, this is what they did. So they hire a shrink, and this shrink says to the government, no, this woman is not insane. Courage in women is often mistaken for insanity.
Right.
And when I tell this, I mean, yeah.
That's where the word
the
hysteria came from, right? Dealing with hysteria.
Yes, we had fainting couches, women were hysterical.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the reasons they were fainting was because they were wearing these bone-crushing, ridiculous, iron-laden bustles that cut the air off. I mean, literally, women... you know, couldn't breathe because of what they were wearing. You know, it's just insane. So, yeah.
So that's the story of Alice Paul. So why is it called the Susan B. Anthony Law? Why did she get credit for it?
No. The 19th Amendment was known as when it was first brought up, the 19th Amendment, which
right.
is the 1920, that's what gave women the right to vote.
Right. Why
and,
is it
yeah,
known?
You're called... Why is it? It's still known as the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, but our amendments have numbers. I mean, I'm not
right.
A government,
I understand, but why is her name on it and not Alice Paul's?
Why is the 19th Amendment known as the Susan B. Anthony Amendment instead of Alice Paul Amendment?
Yes.
I don't know. I never thought about that, and I don't know if Alice Paul didn't want that. Or, I mean, then she writes the Equal Rights Amendment, which was also known as the Lucretia Mott Amendment. The Equal Rights Amendment, yeah, you know, I mean, most people don't know this, and I think if you, you know, look up amendments, I mean, I guess I could look it up right now. I can Google it,
no,
but I'd rather talk to you, but, you know, yeah.
I was just wondering, because it seems like Alice Paul is not getting the credit that she's due for all the hard work she put in.
What? Wait a minute. A woman not getting the credit?
I know. How
too?
Unbelievable.
My head's exploding. I don't even know what to think about that.
Yeah. Amy Simon is with us. We're talking about women's history. It is, of course, Women's History Month, and her play, She's History, a play about women who make and made history. You've got a showing coming up in Los Angeles in a couple of weeks, right? Tell us when and where so people who are in the L.A. area can go here and see.
It's actually next week. It's Sunday, March 18th at 5 p.m. at the Lounge Theater in Hollywood. Free parking on Sunday, LA, as we all know, is a big deal. And all the information is on sheshistory.com. And yeah, Sunday, March 18th at 5 p.m. And I'm also doing another show at the end of March that I'm just doing an excerpt of She's History. It's called I Am Woman, and it's at the Torrance Cultural Arts Center. I don't have anything on my website about it yet, but I will. I'll get it up there. My friend Wendy Hammers, another fabulous female who produces a lot of women's stuff, and that's how we met. She's put together some great evening of different types. It's not just women's history. It's mostly women's empowerment, but I'm the women's history part of the show, you know, surprisingly enough.
Now, for people who don't know, this is a show that you started out as, it's a one-woman show, obviously. That's what you're performing next Sunday. Oh, it's a week from this Sunday. But you also adapted it and made it into a show for a cast that you've been working on with a theater group in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up because I kind of put it down for a little bit. About 4 years ago, I started to adapt this solo play. And the solo play is, you know, the mom is like the tour guide, and I do become some of the women in the show and tell their stories. And there's about 37 women all in total. Some I just mentioned. Some I just tell, you know, show their picture, tell a little bit of their story, you know, like I'll say something about Gloria Steinem and something about Hillary Clinton and tell a little bit there and there. But I wasn't getting the stories of the women out because I was getting a few bookings in schools a little bit here and there, but not good enough. And so my goal remains to create a play, an all-female play written by a woman with all the women's roles played by women, for women, and I want to get it out there into the schools and everywhere else. And it's easier if you have, in some ways, it's a lot easier because you have a lot of parts for women to play. So mm-hmm. I started to work on it, and I did a workshop, and I performed it, and I got some, you know, like Lorraine Newman, and who people know her name. You know, I'm in LA, and it's very helpful when you get a celebrity to work on your project. And she's history just attracts women. So anyway, I've been where it takes. It took a really long time to be able to create it. It's still not even done, but I'm not done with it. I'm still working on it, and I'm going to get back into it this summer. I did a big reading at my Theater West. I did something at Samuel French here in Los Angeles, and I keep tweaking it. It's very difficult to get a play produced, number one. Just any kind of a play produced. It's difficult because of the money. Everybody wants mm-hmm. to do a two-character play with no set because it's easy. It doesn't cost much. But this play covers four centuries. There are 38 roles, but they can all be played by eight women or 38 people. And, right. and I'm working on versions for kids to be played. And I tell it's similar. The tone of it is very similar to the solo play, but it goes much deeper. And we see them a mother raising two daughters and how her life raising them and struggling with society intertwines with the same stories of the women. Like the women are Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Cady Stanton had seven kids. Susan had none. So Susan would go over to Lizzie's house, Elizabeth Cady Stanton's house, and she'd help her with the cooking and the kids while Elizabeth would go write all the speeches that Susan would then go out and make. And that was that fantastic partnership. And, you know, I related to this as, you know, a stay-at-home mom trying to get a job, watch my kids, and my husband wasn't around. And, you know, so that kind of a thread, and many of the women in the story, from Abigail Adams to Bella Abzug, who had a really fantastic life partner, her husband was just great, and she would have never been able to do the work she did without him. So I tell a lot of these stories, but kind of, and I talk about how they suffer and struggle and triumph, you know, but it's very personal. My goal always about women's history, because you hear, it just sounds dry, women's history, but it's not, you know. The women's lives are juicy, and Elizabeth
the stories are great.
A sex maniac. You know, I love talking about that. Like, she got married when she was young, and she goes on her honeymoon, and she's writing about the pleasures of the flesh in her diary, you know. Mm. And she has all these kids. And Susan B. Anthony's always like, for God's sake, will you knock it off having all these kids? Because I got to do all this work. And Elizabeth's like, well, you know, the pleasures of the flesh are the pleasures of the flesh. And, you know, then she'd get mad at Henry, her husband, and she'd be like, no more pleasures of the flesh for you. So, you know, it's really important to bring the humanity of these women and what they really went through. I mean, they were in jail and they were, you know, suffered and beaten and held back and, you know, and they triumphed.
Sure.
You know,
and they're important stories to tell that we don't learn in school.
And you know what? I know this is a little bit off, but I just heard on the news today that President Obama is getting a Netflix show where he's going to tell, you know, stories about education. You know, it's all about education. I don't know any of the details, but I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, he and Michelle are doing it together, and it's not going to be political. It's going to be more about inspiring stories about people. About
hello.
Yeah, Hello. That's what it's all about. Amy Simon, you can find her at sheshistory.com. All the details for the show a week from Sunday, the 18th of March, at the Lounge Theater in Hollywood. It's two blocks east of Vine on Santa Monica Boulevard. And you should go see it if you're in L.A. Amy, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, honey.
Yeah, I'll come back soon, Nicole. Keep doing what you're doing, you fabulous female.
Well, you too, you fabulous female as well. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Amy. Bye. Hey, there was some breaking news. Real quickly, Governor Rick Scott of Florida signed the gun control bill into law. So raising the age to buy guns to 21, a 3-day waiting period, and some other protections. It does arm some teachers, which sucks, but at least this guy with an A-plus rating from the NRA did something. So there's that. All right, have a great weekend, everyone. Don't forget, no new show on Tuesday because I've got jury duty, so I'll see you back here on Wednesday. Thanks for listening. I'm Nicole Sandler. Have a great weekend.